in this area, and if you could enlighten us before I go further.
I don't know if it still exists, but in the area of the state of Michigan in the United States, there is an antenna that is many miles long. It's called Project Sanguine, and it is a low-frequency communication system, or very low or extremely low communication system, which is capable of talking to American submarines anywhere in the world. So is that really an Earth communication system? It might very well be. So you can talk to a submarine anywhere in the world. I think the submarine has to be within 60 feet of the surface, but I'm not sure about that one. And so is it a signal being sent through the ionosphere, or is it a signal being sent through the Earth? There, I'm not sure. But that's long range, anywhere in the world. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
Yeah, all I know is that Mr. Roger was using several of the devices, and his team started to work on it in 1880, and he was able to, I'm trying to find that particular chapter because it's very much interesting. The Department of Navy, before the Second World War, was pretty much interested with it, and he became a very important person just overnight. I lost the chapter. Okay. He was able to demonstrate clearly the underground system and show how it could be used in trench of warfare. He constructed underground station wholly enclosed beneath the surface of the earth, and he was using the Prince George Country area. This is not that one. Okay. I'm gonna save from what I remember. Okay. Basically, what is happening is you take a piece of wire and you bury that wire, let's say 30 feet long wire on one side. You bury this wire and you extend one end of it. Now, from the other side, you do like a dipole, another 30 feet of wire. Now, between these two wires that are coming out of the ground, you're going to use a simple resonance circuit, which would be a resonance circuit in series. That would be a capacitor and a coil. That's the way that you tune. And that is your receiver. There's a transmitter. It's basically looking exactly the same, but you're feeding the power from the amplifier to that resonance circuit, and then it is being transmitted through the earth. Now, in the experiment of Mr. Roger, if he was able to hear very far from the other side of the earth power stations, he was also able to establish the communication for very long, long distance. So we understand that he was the guy who made the first stones based on...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
No, it happened to me. Okay. That was Journal of Communication Volume 4 from May 2009. Now, in here, there is a graphical representation. I also have sent you that one. It's a graphical representation of how that communication is provided. All of the equations required for you to calculate the resonance circuits. And how you're supposed to do that. And how you make the transmitter. How you bury the ground electrodes. and how you provide the impedance model. The impedance. No, it's not the impedance. The receiver model and the transmitter model. I didn't have a chance to read much of it because the nature of my question was quite different, but let me give the microphone back to you.
I am curious as to whether or not when it comes to through the ground communication at these extremely low frequencies or very low frequencies, whether or not you're using the Earth as a volumetric resistor. If I've got a great big block of resistive material, and across two locations on that block, I place a voltage, and maybe it's an ultrasonic voltage. I think one of those talked about a wavelength of 4,000 meters, which I think turns out to be something like 80 kilohertz. So at these ultrasonic or audio frequencies, if I place a voltage across two different points on the block of resistive material, which could be the whole darn Earth, and maybe the crust of the Earth is more conductive than the core, or vice versa, but in one case you're getting a kind of propagation, then if I've got a sensitive enough receiver set up similar to the transmitter, I can be a significant number of miles away and receive that signal. And according to the Rogers article, one of his big claims is that there is no static noise. So you've always got, you've always got lightning storms going on somewhere on the Earth making static, and that static is a very loud clashing noise that's being propagated by the ionosphere. And there's no stopping that. Mother Nature's going to be doing that. You've got continuous convective currents occurring because the sun is shining down on the Earth somewhere, and the air is moving, and particles are being transported, and charge is being transferred into and out of clouds, and you're building up voltages, and you're making lightning and thunder and lots of noise. Below the Earth, except for some seismic activity, none of that is taking place. So I had the impression that communication through the Earth could be subjected to a lot less noise, and if the noise is smaller, that gives you the ability to use a higher amount of gain, as long as your electronics is quiet enough, and therefore you can receive extremely weak signals long distances away. That sounds like a pretty crafty way to go. I wonder how many hams or other experimenters have done this since Mr. Rogers was doing this in the early portion of the 20th century. I wonder how much more work has done since then. Your exposure would lead you to believe that it became a proprietary piece of information, possibly a military secret. N2XJM, K2RIW.
N2XJM. Well, one of the modern ways that the ham radio amateurs are dealing with it is they correct the sound cards, sampling rate and compensated drift, and they use MSK, modulated transmitters in VLF range. And it works with the sound card sampling rate of 48 kilo samples per second. And they are able to make a quite significant ranges. So the distance from Europe to United States is not a big deal. But this is not what actually caught my attention. When I was looking for the possible sources of unexplored energy, untapped energy, whatever it is, I was looking for something that is variable. And here you already have. The earthquakes. In 2010, geoscientists proved what was known to few, and they announced that the Demeter satellite observed a dramatic increase of ULF radio waves over Haiti in months before the magnitude 7 of earthquake. Researchers then start to attempt to learn more about correlation between The electromagnetic wave created by the Earth by itself, and they're present before the earthquake. My understanding is that electromagnetic wave is an energy. Therefore, this energy could be caught, rectified, and reused. That's one of the very much, I would say, courageous statement I can make. But the question is, why nobody knows about it? Why don't we talk about it? Why something that was known in 50s, at least I got across that in 50s, now is the big woe in December 9, 2010. And still, no more information about it. Back to you.
Yeah, Don, good question. Is it because of lack of interest? It's hard to keep material like this secret if that's what it really was. If it's got military application.
But let me interrupt you. We had the disaster in Japan. And the scientists knew that these waves were readable. They have a satellite who is able to gather that. Nobody knows about it. What was the reason of hiding this information and to exist?
The fact that these waves were detected before the Haiti event makes you and I start asking the question, were there similar ULF waves that could have been detected by a satellite or any other means before the Japanese earthquake event? And is this a method of giving forewarning? Sure, it would be nice to know that you get some significant amount of forewarning time that an earthquake is about to happen. But I'm wondering now, does every earthquake have a precursor signal of a ULF wave? Maybe only certain portions of the Earth that have certain local magnetic fields or whatever do this, and maybe not every earthquake is detectable that way. If even half of them are detectable that way, that'd be a good thing to know. I don't know. When it comes to free energy, a friend of mine has been working on free energy for a long time, of a different form. He is positive that the North American Gyre, in other words, the so-called Atlantic, what would you call it now, the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream has a tremendous amount of energy that could be captured if you're willing to put down the turbines below the surface of the water in the vicinity of the Gulf of Mexico and the east coast of Florida and so on. Tremendous amounts of energy are available. And that you could call it thermal energy. Let me drop.
T2L.
I'm already recognized. You could call it thermal energy because the sun is beating down on the water, heating it up, and it's one of the main mechanisms by which you get the Gulf Stream flow. And zillions of gallons of water are flowing at a significant rate, and lots of energy is there. Go ahead, Bernie. YO, K2RIW.
Steve Dick in the net. My understanding is that they did have forewarning of the Japan quake. It was only on the order of 15 to 30 seconds, but they did have forewarning, is my understanding. I read that in a press article.
You read that in a press article, and to your knowledge, was that a speculation or reasonably well documented? Did it come from a good source? And why was the Haiti forewarning a whole lot of hours or days, and Japan only 15 seconds or whatever? I wonder if there's any explanation for all of that. Go ahead, Bernie.
I don't remember the source, but at the time I sensed that it was reputable. Obviously, coming from California, earthquakes are something that are personal, and I do have interest in. Why they got more warning in Haiti, don't know. But the press did comment that the warnings had gone out in Japan, but it was only enough to maybe deafen or something. You know, it was not the type of warning that we really need to change lives.
KC2, QIQ with a question for Bernie.
You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Bernie. Just a question for you. I heard that there was some advanced warnings that they get for the tsunamis. In other words, because I guess from the time that the earthquake takes place, that they can detect that with ocean detectors and then determine if a wave is coming and set off alarms and sirens and things. But is this pre-warning of the earthquake pressures or whatever, is that something that where there's enough time where they can actually warn the public to do something? KC2QIQ, back to you, Bernie, then over to Dick, K2RIW.
The tsunami warnings, to my understanding, the Pacific is lined, well, I'm going to say lined with buoys. It's a big ocean, so there's no way we could fill it. But they have a line of buoys across the Pacific that they can detect the tsunamis moving. The earthquake, I haven't really looked for nor found any additional information about the forewarning on the earthquake. Having been in an earthquake, 15-second warning of it coming now could make a huge difference. I've been through three major quakes, meaning six and above, and yeah, 15 seconds could make a huge difference. But I don't know how they're doing it, and I don't know if they could get bigger, bigger time frames.
KC2YDT with the comment.
Go ahead, Matt.
Okay, I know if you look at the U.S. Geological Survey, for example, we have detectors out on all the fault lines, and the way they're able to tell, if there's a quake is, they'll see if there's any seismic activity. I know before a quake, before it actually hits, there's a very little bit of seismic activity way on the ground that picks up on these detections, and that's how they're able to give the warning. But because it's a quake, it depends on where the start of it is. And of how long you're going to have for warning. And also, if you look at NOAA.gov and just pan out to the open water, you'll see numerous buoys out there. There's several strictly for tsunami purposes. And it'll tell you how high the wave is, and that's how they're able to calculate if there's a tsunami coming. KC2YDT, back to net.
Okay, Georgia.
You got it, Eric. Now, if you want more information on the UF warnings of earthquakes, go to tbs.org and look at the episode on earthquakes. And you'll see all the research that's going on and by whom. Believe it or not, even in the University of Columbia University is doing work on that, too. But, yeah, they found that, from what I remember, they can sometimes detect maybe 15 seconds before the event, and sometimes a little longer, but it's not an exact science at this point.
Here we go, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, you've probably heard, it may have been on PBS that I saw it, but I've seen stories where animals, people's dogs, people's cats can, they sense that something is going to happen hours or even a day before. And, I don't know, there's a lot we don't know. Their senses are much sharper than ours, because I know that when people walk on the street, there's no reaction. When somebody's coming up to the house, my cat seems to know. He knows when somebody is coming up to the door about a minute before they get to the door. So it's not unreasonable to assume that these stories about animals being able to detect earthquakes is reasonable.
K2IO's anecdotal data.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Back in the late 80s, and I don't remember, it was probably 88, 89, I was out one morning getting some exercise, and I noticed a couple of, I'm going to call them sparrows. They were small birds down at ground level, just behaving extremely oddly, fighting with each other, seemingly unable to fly correctly. And I looked at it and went, huh, they're acting odd. I wonder if there's an earthquake coming. And later on that day, about 11 o'clock, boom, we had about a 6.1 shake, I believe. So I can't say that that was absolutely related, but it was funny that it popped into my head that, gee, those birds are acting funny. That might be an earthquake. And we didn't have any forewarning. We didn't have any, you know, gee, it's coming, other than the usual California, the big one's coming someday.
Comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, as you know, Coastal Geodetic and quite a few other people have all of these sensors throughout our continent and other places in the world, and they're monitoring our continent drifting about 2 inches a year to the west. We're moving in that direction. So they have information coming in 24/7. The only problem is they don't know which signal is the precursor, and that's what they're using the Cray computers for and things like that, to assimilate all this data and try to come up with some kind of formula. And I think that's where we're going to get the answers from. But those signals are coming in constantly.
Answer your same question.
You got it, Wesley?
Based on a number of articles that I have in front of me, and I sent you a few, question for you. What is the base? And there is a group of very smart people on this computer. What is the phase of radio wave at ultra-low frequency being created by itself? Does anybody is able to give me the answer? Glenn Dick, Eric, and others. Frequencies, this radio waves, are so intense that could be picked up by the satellite. And they were, and there is an evidence for it. Enter Jim.
You're talking about ELIM?
Yeah, I'm talking about ULF. One of the sources is, you go to Wikipedia, and right before Earth mode communication, you have, on December 9, 2010, geoscientists announced that D-meter satellite observed a dramatic increase of ULF radio waves over Haiti in months before magnitude 7.0 earthquake. Researchers are attempting to learn much whatsoever.
I take it, Dick.
You got it, Eric.
No, I'll say this much, because I signed a piece of paper saying I can't say much of anything. There are satellites that go around the Earth that essentially record the entire electromagnetic spectrum and then dump it when it comes over a certain place on the Earth. So as far as the military and the government, they have a certain awareness, okay, and that's about as much as I can say.
Yeah, for me, it is kind of strange. If we have a naturally occurring electromagnetic wave, we have a free energy. Although this is not a free energy, it's the, because nothing comes for free, it is the energy that's free of charge. And to exit.
But it takes orders of magnitude being just detectable and yet being large enough that you can use it for useful energy output. We're burning up, what is it, 21 million barrels a day of imported oil. That's a lot of joules of energy that we need. And so a signal that is just detectable, in many cases, is a microvolt or a nanovolt. And the amount of signal that we need has got tremendous amounts of increase of energy to be useful for powering machines and running vehicles and running factories and so on.
Hey, Dick, you do that every day with your RFID devices, yeah?
Yeah, dream on. They're never allowed to go more than 1 watt of power, never more than 6 dB of antenna gain. So that's a plus 4 watts of effective radiated power. And to be on that license-free band, it's got to continuously be hopping across those 50 channels between 902 and 928 megacycles. So you're not jamming all the other people using that service. So they're all hopping all over the place. That's not much energy, Eric. And in many cases, those portable readers are running on battery power. So by your and my standards, they're real flea power. Right back to you, Eric.
No, with anything else, you've got more than, you know, you could do it. I mean, come on, the sun makes, what, 1,400 watts per square meter? I suppose you can do that with anything. I mean, you know, the big, was it a NASA idea to put the collectors out in space and microwave the energy back down?
Yeah, there have been quite a few decades of study of the so-called solar power satellites. And that whole idea is to have a number of square miles of solar cells in synchronous orbit collecting sunlight. And in those days, the sunlight was going to be converted to electrical power that was going to run high power 2 gigahertz microwave tubes. And the multiple square miles of solar array was also going to be multiple square miles of antenna. And you aim that 2 gigahertz beam down to a place like Arizona, where you had a great big rectifying antenna on the ground across a few square miles. And now, in theory, you're transmitting solar energy to the Earth 24 hours a day. Let me drop. That's the good news. You get into the economics of doing it, and you find out it's very unfavorable. Every single satellite that we have ever put into synchronous orbit is at 22,300 miles. The best space bus that we have ever created was the shuttle. And the shuttle can never exceed 600 miles above Earth's surface. Synchronous orbit is 23,000 miles, and 0.6,000 miles is the highest you can ever put the shuttle. So you, no matter what you put in synchronous orbit, with reasonable probability, you can say that no human eyes will never see it again. No human hand will ever touch it again. You put something in a synchronous orbit, for all practical purposes, it's out of this world. Well, you make something that's a few square miles of solar cells and a few square miles of phased array antenna with a few zillion individual transmitters all summed together. No matter what you do, that hardware is going to need significant continuous maintenance. Okay, you can envision a whole lot of robots you send out there to do that maintenance. Let me drop. But who's going to maintain the robots? Whatever you put into synchronous orbit, with essentially no exception, has never been brought back to Earth. Never been brought back down to a parking orbit around the Earth. The total amount of energy it takes to get something in synchronous orbit, I'm not sure of the exact number, but it's probably half the amount of energy to get it to the moon. Maybe it's one third, but you know what I mean. Tremendous amounts of energy to get something there. And to now go there and repair it, or even to send a robot there to do the repair and do all that by remote control. You look at the economics of launching that much hardware, that many zillions of pounds of hardware, that many thousands of miles into space, and in synchronous orbit, and you're putting it into this nice circular orbit and very well controlling its position so that it's not crashing into all the other things that are in synchronous orbit. Synchronous orbit is a string of beads. It's one-dimensional real estate. It's got a very specific latitude, very specific altitude, and the only thing you've got as an address is the longitude, and you better stay in that particular longitude. If you drift because of the Earth mass concentrations, you're going to be crashing into everything else. You look at the economics of it. Let me drop. And by the way, in 1980 dollars, the total solar power satellite system was estimated to be $3.5 trillion in 1980 dollars. That's on the assumption you could assemble all of that boosting hardware, all of that hardware to be put into space, all of that, people to run all this and whatever. You look at the economics and you're going to be way ahead of the game to convert one-third of the state of Arizona into solar cells. You're way ahead of the game. And yes, you don't get solar energy at nighttime, but you find some other way of doing that or some way of storing the energy. You pump water uphill and let it run back downhill from a dam to run a turbine at nighttime. So solar power satellite is a great sounding idea. And with a space elevator, it becomes a little bit more feasible. But the space elevator is based on a whole lot of speculations of being able to create tremendous lengths of graphite reinforced materials that have ridiculous strength to weight ratios. So each of these projects are good for a study, but right now are not economically viable. I'd much rather see the Gulf Stream, the tides, the wind, and solar voltaics as ways of gathering energy. And we've got comments on all of the above. K2RIW in the TechNet.
By the way, there is a turbine in Hell's Gate in the East River.
Yeah, that's one of the first ones. But can you imagine putting one of those in the Gulf Stream on the east coast of Florida and make a whole array of them? You're going to get gigawatts of power out of that. Over to you, Eric.
Too bad for NIMBYisms. We had that discussion about the turbines that could be off Jones Beach. But anyway, I got in front of a computer and I couldn't pull that out of my brain before. But the thing about U-238 is you can cause a fissionable reaction with fast neutrons hitting it, but it won't support a chain reaction because of inelastic scattering, which reduces the neutron energy below the level where fission is probable. So that's the issue with 238. The Germans have actually, what they did was, I don't know if you're aware of it, but in Berlin, they pay a fixed rate for electricity for the next 20 years, which is slightly more than what they used to pay. But what that money has done is they have created their own solar voltaic factories, and everywhere there's open space now in Germany, along the Autobahn and lots of places, there are solar farmers. Farmers actually put solar panels on their land. Germany's not that big a place. I mean, they don't have to transport energy that far, so they have less of a problem than we do. Let me drop. But they're really into it, and they are one of the most green, renewable energy generators of the world. It's funny. We create the technology, and everybody else uses it. Dick?
Yeah, there was a very nice PBS special on this exact subject, Eric, on your station, which basically said that they polled the German population and said, are you people serious? Do you really want to be green? And the answer was yes, yes, yes. Okay, prove it. Are you willing to pay a higher price for your electricity so that we could subsidize these solar voltaic farms? That each person who puts up a solar voltaic farm is going to be guaranteed, I forget the exact numbers, but I think the person who is pumping electric energy back into the German grid is being paid 12 or 13 or 14 cents a kilowatt hour, whereas the people who are consuming with the premium, they're paying something like 20 cents a kilowatt hour. And that is a huge incentive. Now people are putting solar voltaics on their roof, in their backyard, on the unused spaces along the Autobahn, all kinds of places. They're really getting serious about solar voltaic. It's a very good incentive program. I'd like to believe it's possible to set up an incentive program somewhat like that for wind or solar voltaic here, where if there is a guaranteed price that you're going to be paid for each kilowatt hour you pump back into the grid, that will give people the enthusiasm to go and install those renewable energy sources. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Anyone else?
Fred recognized, but Eric first.
Well, you look at the latest statistics, the plan has been growing and growing and growing and growing. and they're reducing the amount of fossil fuel that they burn. They still have nuclear power plants, but those things still run. But they've actually been reducing the amount of output of many of the fossil fuel generators still. I mean, you still have the nighttime issue when there's no sun and no energy. But it all balances out in terms of how much energy, you know, how much waste they throw in the air, and they can be proud. They're really proud of what they're doing. It's just too bad that the oil companies and the other corporate controllers of the things that go on in this country just don't want to join the bandwagon. And to really make it happen over there, they've created their own manufacturing facilities. So it's hard to get solar panels in this country because they make them, they buy them, they don't sell them to us. K2RW, K2J.
K2QIQ.
Okay, we got four people lined up. Fred first. We've got a lot of people out of work. We have a need for energy. Those people could be manufacturing the hardware that gives us renewable energy, installing the hardware that gives us renewable energy. This would be the modern-day equivalent of the WPA, Works Projects Administration, which helped get us out of a recession way back in the late 30s and early 40s. I think it's time for something like that again. K1FC, wait for the four beeps, Fred, and you've only got a minute and a half before you got to interrupt. K2RW, you got it, Fred.
I just wanted to give you the term. When you make adjustments, it's called a Segovian tax. And I have my favorite question, whenever I ask somebody running for office, it's not very often, if they know the difference between Keynesian and Segovian economic theory. But basically, what a Segovian tax is, when you have an adjustment in a market to take care of externalities. And the energy market, of course, is the obvious one, where your externality is the production of carbon dioxide and whatnot, or other undesirable factors. And one way or another, you have to have some tax that could be cap and trade, it could be a carbon tax, but marketplace, the energy marketplace does require an adjustment for the externalities. Thank you, Dick. K1FC.
Thank you, Fred. I think we've got Wesley, Bernie, and Glenn in that order, and maybe there's a fourth person. Wesley, go ahead with your comment.
Yeah, I'm going to come for the moment to the time of Nikola Tesla and mysterious Alf and Resonance. I'm going to spell it for you guys. ALFVEN. Resonance, which actually occurs at 0.9 hertz. It has been known that the Earth has natural electromagnetic resonance. If the radio signal is sent out from point A, it will then travel around the opposite side of the planet to antipode at point B, and then continue travel around back to the point A. If the new signal is sent, at the same time, the first signal arrives back. Then two will add together and seem to resonate between themselves. There was a calculation that was actually made by measuring the speed of light and then the distance traveled, which was 186,000 miles divided by 24,000 miles, whatsoever, I'm not going to go to. It came to the point of 8 hertz. Now, the point is that it is assumed that radio static from large lighting discharges follow the pattern and can be heard on ULF radio receivers, and it's going to be overlapping randomly at damped waves of 8 hertz. There is another phenomenon which is being called Schumann resonance, S-C-H-U-M-A-N-N, let me drop. And this one is down to 0.9 to 1 hertz. These are very much scientific data, so it's out of questions, at least for now. till it will be changed. When we had the earthquake in Japan, we could utilize, and anybody could utilize, a number of devices like magnetometers, seismic sensors, and they could listen to these signals. As these signals could be sensed with various numbers of reasons, also using the satellite that I have mentioned. So, John was the one who was listening to these noises for a long time. I wonder what John has to say about it.
Yeah, if we pick up these other guys with their comments, we're going to go back to John, and I think he has built a whistler detector. I'd like to hear about that. Bernie was the next person on the list. Go right ahead. K2YO, K2YW in the TechNet.
I was just going to comment on the solar panel issue. A very good friend of mine lives out in Farmingdale and put a solar array on his roof. I would say that his house is roughly the same size as mine, averaging out, you know, two-story house, 2,000 square feet, somewhere around there. He has many more facets to his roof. I have two primary facets. He has probably six or seven facets. Anyway, 2010 was the first year that he had his array online full-time for the whole year, and he netted out. He's not running batteries. He's using LIPA as his battery packs. But it netted out for the year that he had a positive generation factor. He actually sold more than he had been used from LIPA. He still pays, I'm going to say, roughly $25 a month access fee to the grid, but it ended up last year that LIPA actually owed him money more than he owed them money for electrical possibilities. So it's there. Now, let's talk numbers. He spent about $65,000. He got a government fund back for about 30 of that. He's looking at about a five-year payback. I don't know how many people could fund that right now. And that's going to be one of the challenges. Also, he said that the money he gets, the kickback he got, I believe it was from the federal government, he said there is no more of that money right now. So if I were to install right now, I'd have to put the whole $65,000. But supposedly they're working on getting some more of that money. But yeah, the big challenge is, are you willing to front $65,000, and how long will it take to pay it off? Back to you,
Dave. You could use a little bit more audio, Bernie. Your audio is a couple of dB low, but it sounded very clean. Wow, those are very nice payback periods, 5 years now, and even if he had to pay the whole thing himself and wasn't getting that subsidy, I think we're coming out with numbers like 12 years of payback, of return on investment. And that's not a big profit-making thing, but a certain number of green people will go for that if they got the right layout. And the nice thing about a system like that is, on the hottest sunny day, when you're cranking out the most amount of air conditioning, you use the most amount of power, that's when your solar voltaics are giving you the most amount of voltage. It's a beautiful win-win-like situation. Unless you make really big 150-foot, 200-foot diameter blades, wind doesn't give you very much power. It goes up by, I think, the cube law of diameter. But solar voltaics are linear. Every time you double the amount of solar panel square feet, you get twice the amount of solar power. That's awfully nice. And as time goes on, I think solar voltaics are becoming more efficient. You know, a higher percentage of efficiency of solar conversion into electricity, and cheaper. So those payback periods are going to come down. And I'm not convinced you have to go through the elaborate scheme of aiming the solar cells. Just put enough of them down, and there's ways of setting up individual little bitty reflectors on them so that they almost become self-aiming. Good way to go. Hey, Dick. Glenn's going to be next, but go ahead, Eric.
I don't know if you've ever been to the UNLV, University of Las Vegas. They have an array of solar cells that are focused. It's not very large. But that single array produces 135 kilowatts of energy, and it's quite amazing. And the technology to do that has been there now for about 5 or 6 years.
This array, 135 kilowatts. The average house only needs 2 kilowatts on average over a 24-hour period. So additional 135 kilowatts is like 75 houses worth. This power station that's almost good for 75 houses, does it fill up an acre? Over to you, Eric.
AB2HZ.
Negative. The thing is about, I think it was 18 feet by 24 feet. It's not that big.
KB2HZ, I actually seen it. Sorry to break into the net. Just want to let you guys know I've actually seen it. I was actually there. Over.
What's your name and tell us what you saw?
This is KB2HZE. Name is Tom in the Bronx. I actually lived out in Vegas for 3 years, and I had a friend that went to the university, and I actually seen the solar array. Very, very interesting how it's set up and what have you.
Roughly how big was it?
The dimensions are like 18 by 24. I only see one side of it, actually, to tell you the truth. But it was amazing just to see how it was all put together and what have you. And a good group of people put it together, from what I was told, over.
Now, Eric, the numbers don't seem quite right. I think average solar cells are running 10 or 15%. The raw solar power is a little bit more than a kilowatt per square foot.
It's not a solar cell, Dick.
Okay. What is it?
It's all focused dioxide lasers in front of it. Actually, there's another solar array there that runs a Stirling engine, which is just a series of mirrors. This is an absorption device. It looks like a solid hunk of metal with little holes in it, which actually have lenses and a cooling system behind it.
So it heats water that runs a turbine? Is that approximately what's going on, Eric?
That's it.
Interesting. KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I didn't want to go too far off topic on this one. I wanted to get back to the solar voltaics again. I mean, there's other technologies that are out there. A lot of it's being done on the West Coast already. And just to make a quick point here, here in the United States, solar voltaic energy is cheaper here than anywhere else in the world. The sources are coming from China, Hong Kong, Taiwan. You can get the stuff here. Right now, you can buy pallets if you want to do it yourself. Right now, pallets are somewhere like around, they're under $2.50 a watt right now. So, I mean, realistically, you want to do 10 kilowatts of panels on your roof, talking somewhere around $25,000. Go to Europe, it's going to be four times that in euros. I mean, it's ridiculous. You can get inverters here. We can get European inverters. You can get American. There's companies like Cobra who are having the stuff. You remember the radar detectors and things like that? And the CBs, they're making inverters today. You can get these things right out of China. They're sending them here. I just think it's being advertised very, very poorly. And the ability to, the amount of contractors out there are kind of limited. But, and the contractors are kind of marking it up here a little bit. But if, for the do-it-yourselfer, if you want to lay out like 25 grand, you could put up a 10-kilowatt system right on your house. And, you're going to be pretty darn close to break-even, I would think, with that kind of system, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The sun is not here. The same one as in California.
Well, it's enough, as Dick mentioned before, the hottest time of year when all of our air conditioners and everything on is in the summer. That's when you need it most. That's when everything starts breaking down. Back to you, Dick.
Question for Glenn. He said he had a question.
Okay, yep. John and Tom in that order. John, go ahead.
Glenn, if you can, could you give us some square footage on that for that kind of KW?
I think right now somewhere like around 200 watts is like, a square meter, give or take. They're not the most efficient cells in the world, but they're kind of cheap. I'll give you a good thing to look up is solarhome.org, www.solarhome.org, and everything's on there. I mean, you can do all this stuff yourself. It comes to the brackets, the panels, inverters, everything that you need to do is right there. And as I said, just telling you right now, if you wanted to do around 10 kilowatts, which is what I would advise, somewhere around, for this area, around 10 kilowatt system, and your outlay is going to be somewhere around $25,000. Granted, it's not cheap, but here again, it's a lot better than nuclear. KC2QIQ.
SolarHome.com.
K2KEY, I'll give you a comment on it.
Okay, we're going to have Tom and then some guy named Mel, in that order. And if either of you guys have a chart in head or you know of dollars per kilowatt now versus a year ago, 10 years ago, a year from now. In other words, if I make a curve of any of these energy conversion systems, of how many dollars I have to pay for how many kilowatts I get out, I'd like to believe the curve is going down. I'd like to know how fast it's going down. If right now 10 kilowatts cost me $25,000, that's a marking point. Tom is next, KB2HZE in the Bronx, K2RIW. Go ahead, Tom.
All right, K2RIW in the net. This is KB2HZE. All right, first, I see, like, ham radio outlets sell these panels and stuff. I actually have a friend in Florida who actually runs his whole house via solar panels. And also in my area, just real quick, just to let you know, there's a lady that lives in my area in Silver Beach, where it's like a little bit of a private community right next to the Whitestone, I mean to the Dog's Neck Bridge. She actually has solar panels all over her roof.
And the payback must be good because the Germans are doing it like it's going out of style. And those guys in Manhattan Beach, I wonder how many solar conversion schemes, whether it's solar voltaic or solar thermal or whatever. I wonder how many of them you know of in your neighborhood, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Believe none. Now I'll tell you why. I inquired, and I said, what's the story? And they said, well, I said, I can do it yourself. Yes, $25,000. That's for materials. Now you got the labor, and everything has got to be done where the Edison company will authorize the connection to their system, because they got to change the meter and this thing and that thing, and it's got to be done by not a regular licensed electrician. They got a specified people that'll do this. Then there's the insurance factor. Then on top of it all, it's the building department giving you a okay. They got a lot of different technical and paperwork things to do here that the people that inquired, that I know, a couple of my neighbors building new houses, I said, oh, put in solar. You're going to be here for at least maybe 25 years. For me, it's too late already. I'm my age. But the end result was that they said the outlay, it's a lot more than $65,000 who winds up there going.
And KC2QAQ would comment?
Yeah, that's a little bit discouraging. When it comes back to any of you guys, I'm going to be asking the question, have they created too much regulatory impediments in the five boroughs of New York City? I'd like to believe Nassau and Suffolk is not quite that restrictive. And on top of that, if Obama wants to give us incentive to become more energy independent, then we've got to do something to remove some of these impediments. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
K2RIW.
Bernie recognized after Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about cost in the systems right now is that the cost of these systems in the, let's say, at the material level has gone down probably over the last 10 years, somewhere maybe about 20%. Not a whole lot, Dick. As a matter of fact, the volumes have been coming up, but the material cost is kind of holding heavy, I mean steady, excuse me. But what's really interesting is that where people are getting ripped off is the installers right now who are putting this stuff in are really, really charging, and that price is going up. So I guess because labor cost or whatever it is, those costs are going way up. And there's also regulation problems when you have somebody putting it in. In other words, you have to have insurance, somebody who's going to install this stuff and needing codes and everything else. But here's the trick to this. If you do it yourself, basically most of these regulations don't mean anything. These are real. Most of the regulations that I've seen on the books so far only really account for contractors who are going to come in to do the work. But if you do it yourself and you want to have it connected by a regular electrician who's going to put in the other box, a regular electrician can actually make the connection, and there's no meter change necessary to do this. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, well, the building department won't sanction it.
But you have to be able to, some neighborhoods will not allow you to put solar panels up, period, but that's a different story.
In my area, KB2HZE, they winded up finding her for not getting permits.
Yeah, in the five boroughs of New York City where they've got some very restrictive rules, I can see how there's a problem. I'd like to believe Nassau and Suffolk are not quite that bad. Do you have reason to believe, Glenn first, and then I'm going to go over to Bernie. Glenn, do you have reason to believe that if you and I installed the system and did a pretty good job, then we had, we made sure that we used an approved brand name and model number of the device that converts the thermal energy into electrical energy so that the device that's going to be connected to LUCO's grid, LIPA's grid, is an approved device. As long as I've got that, and I've got some licensed contractor, I've got a licensing authority to look over my shoulder and say, yes, you did it right, and he signs off on it. Can I then do a self-installation in Nassau or Suffolk County and not run into such huge regulatory problems that it just completely discourages me? What do you think, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
We won't get a rebate from LIPA.
Yeah, we've already found out that that's already gone, that particular incentive has already been removed, and we've already decided that maybe we're going to have to pay for the whole thing. Over to you, Glenn.
They're just waiting for the next fiscal year to get another $2.5 million for it.
Okay, so there's money on the way. Back to you, Glenn.
Okay, this is what I know so far, because I've been looking into this a lot, and I've got friends who are actually doing installations and contractors who are doing this. If you do it yourself, you'll save more than whatever incentive that will ever come out in the future. Trust me on that one. So if you do it yourself, but you do have to do a little bit of background check for your area just to make sure that you're allowed to put them up, period. There may be some towns where they're just not going to allow you to put up solar panels at all. But for most areas of Nassau and Suffolk County that I've seen so far, there are really not much of any limitations for doing it yourself. As far as the devices that you're using, the panels are low voltage. There's no concern there whatsoever. The inverters, here again, they're not going to be regulatory devices. The devices that are going to be that you're going to have code issues with are the enclosures, the boxes. In other words, when you do the inverters, you have to put them in approved metal boxes. In other words, fireproof boxes, just like you would normal circuit breakers and everything else. The circuit breakers that connect up to your electrical box all have to be approved, and the ones that meet all the code for your area. So it's the boxes and the circuit breakers and how it's attached to the panel. And there's plenty of information out here. Like if you go onto these solarpanel.orgs, the equipment, the boxes, everything is there. And you can have a regular electrician make the connection. So if you do it yourself, I think you're going to be ahead of the game, and don't worry about getting, any grants in the future. But like you said, if you're going to go out and have contractors put in, it's going to cost you a fortune anyway and just might make it not worthwhile, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment, Dick.
And K2J. Okay, we've got a long list of people. One last question, Glenn. Are you still convinced that right now I can probably create 10 kilowatts worth for about $25,000? Is that the approximate ballpark figure that you think is possible, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, I'm looking at the website right now, and I'll tell you that panels by the pallet, starting at $2.35 a watt, 10,000 watts, you're talking $23.50 for just the panels. Inverters are relatively cheap. They're a few hundred dollars a piece. And, a typical inverter is like maybe, a few hundred dollars, but that's a 1,500-watt inverter. I would say when you do a basic string of a kilowatt, I would put basically a 1,500-watt inverter on a 1 kilowatt worth of loading of panels. So if you're doing 10 kilowatts, you're going to need 10 inverters. So that's like another a little bit more than $1,000. So you can see where I'm coming from the numbers, and just take a look at the website, Dick. You can add it up. But it's going to come, about 10 kilowatts, it's going to be around that $25,000 area for your installation, plus some other hardware that goes in. But it's going to be close. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
How soon are you going to do it, Glenn?
Well, I'm looking at the cost of things right now and looking at a lot of different systems, and every time I'm getting prepared to put one up, I keep looking at it and I want to do something different again. So I've got to settle in on which system I actually want to put in. Back to you, Dick. When are you putting yours in?
I'm giving it some stronger and stronger thought. Bernie is the next guy, K2IO. Go right ahead.
I had a comment.
To address Mel's concern, I looked at it both for my house in Garden City and for a building in Queens. and the five boroughs restrictions were significantly more restrictive, Town of Garden City said, yeah, as long as they're not an eyesore, I would have to get a variance. As long as you can't see them in my house, you can't see my roof from the street. They didn't expect any kind of a problem. They do want electrical inspections. So, yeah, it was significantly easier.